Pretty eventful night in the NBA. Thought, you know, I'll just have thoughts on Raptors playing Kawhi and how it feels right now. And then the Raptors come out looking great. And they fritter another one away. They drop again to 3 games below .500 and continue this just annoying stretch of basketball where they can look really, really great for a quarter. They get some really, really solid individual performances, and yet it still doesn't feel like the pieces fit together. And then Kevin Durant gets hurt yesterday. He's apparently in a walking boot. The West could not be more wide open. I think everybody wants Kevin Durant to be healthy at this point. Like, who doesn't want to see him try and get back to the top of the mountain with this Suns team, especially since it's like with Chris Paul? It just seems like a more likable Suns team than the situation that he had created for himself in Brooklyn, and especially the one that he had in Golden State. But then a Raptors game that I still have a bunch of thoughts on when it comes to Kawhi gets completely hijacked narrative-wise, because once again, the refs. Once again, ref talk in Toronto comes to the forefront. So Fred VanVleet hits the podium. I went to bed. I didn't see this live. I woke up this morning to it. And yeah, I think you can probably guess my natural immediate instinct whenever the ref stuff comes up, but I've been thinking about it essentially for an hour and a half. But for those of you that have not heard it yet, because, yeah, you decided to go to bed when the Raptors were down 10, or you just decided, hey, watching a team that is under 500 and kind of mediocre is not worth staying up late for on a weekday. Well, here's what Fred VanVleet had to say about the official Ben Taylor in this game.
I thought, you know, Ben Taylor was f***ing terrible tonight. I thought that on most nights, you know, a couple of the, you know, out of the three, there's one or two that just f*** the game up, you know, and it's been like that a couple games in a row. Denver was tough, obviously. You come out tonight, you're competing pretty hard. The third quarter, I get a bullshit tech, changes the whole dynamic of the game, changes the whole flow of the game. And, you know, most of the refs are trying hard. I like a lot of the refs are trying hard. They're pretty fair. They communicate well. And then you got the other ones who just want to be d***s and just kind of f*** the game up. Nobody's coming to see that shit. They come to see the players. And I think we're losing a little bit of the fabric of what the NBA is and was. And it's been disappointing this season. You can look up most of my texts this year have been with Ben Taylor officiating. So at a certain point as a player, you feel it's personal. And it's never a good place to be. That's not why we lost tonight. We got outplayed. But it definitely makes it tougher to overcome.
I got to tell you, there's a lot of this that I really don't like. Fred is well within his right as a former All-Star, as a veteran in this league, as the leader of his team, to take this approach in the regular season and try to deflect some of the blame for what's been going on with the Raptors. I get it. And I'm sure that he and Ben Dowsett, Ben Taylor, I don't know why I said Dowsett. I think that's actually a writer. That they actually have some kind of real relationship with Animus. And that sucks. I hate that. There's nothing that drives me more insane. I know I was joking about officiating and bad officiating being just one of the fun things about sports and how we should just embrace it a little bit more sometimes that we get to be so mad at officials. But nothing makes me angrier about officiating. Not the mistakes. The mistakes are fine. Who cares? That's going to happen. Human error, we have to accept that that's going to happen. There's not a 100% success rate for any job with people. Like, it's not going to happen. Especially one where there's a lot of flash plays and subjective moments. What I cannot stand about officials is what Fred says there at the end, which is, hey, the people didn't come here to see you. And there are some officials, I don't think that's the way they think about it, but they certainly feel as though they are a more involved part of the game than they should be. Are there times in sports where the officials need to quote-unquote take control of the game or do their job a little bit better to make sure that they handle a game script the right way? that comes with years and years of being a veteran official? Absolutely. I was talking about this the other day, again, with Ben, where if you've got a game and it's 15-0 and the rain is coming, expand the strike zone. That's okay. Fans aren't going to be upset about it. That's just being a veteran official. If you've got a game that's starting to get a little chippy and you want it to not get out of control, start tightening the whistle a little bit. Make sure that you hit a few more calls. Think those are pretty common sense. What is the worst is when some of these officials carry grudges. And we know this is a real thing. Like, we obviously know this is a real thing. This isn't just the Tim Donahue's of the world, right? Like, who we can't even take anything he's really saying at face value anymore because he's spun it out into so many different things and fabrications and selective truth-tellings. But one thing that he has said that I believe very, 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 very much is stuff like when he references playing against Allen Iverson and guys trying to screw over certain players. I think that the league has probably gotten a lot better. There's certainly a different level of accountability in the internet era when it comes to officials like this. But I also think there's something too, like Scott Foster's record against Chris Paul. I don't think that that's a complete fabrication. I think that stuff gets blown out of proportion from time to time. But there is some reality in it. It's also human nature just not to like somebody. There are certain people where you just don't like them. And if you're the official, yeah, I think that you're more likely to be lenient to people that you like and to be harsher on people you don't. And Fred obviously rubs this one official the wrong way. And that sucks. And I hate that. And it drives me nuts. It drives me insane that there are officials with personal vendettas. That said, it's also kind of just a human nature thing. So I don't know how I can be too mad about it. And I also don't think that Fred VanVleet stepping up to a podium is going to ingratiate himself in any way to officials and make this issue better. Maybe it does in the short term. Maybe when all eyes are on the Raptors from an officiating standpoint for the next couple of days, some of the officials have that in their heads. Maybe it is somewhere a little bit into the subconscious, but ultimately I think in the long run, this kind of stuff will probably more likely than not end up hurting you or end up damaging those relationships. And I don't really think Fred VanVleet stepping up and saying, I think most officials try hard, is going to do much to swing things the other way. Anyway, I hated that he left. We didn't lose the game tonight because of the refs. We got outplayed until the very end. This is the kind of quote that is obviously going to pop to the top of headlines. And I'm sure that wasn't his intention, right? Like, I don't think this guy is trying to deflect the blame. Fred VanVleet's a winner, and I think he's a leader. I think some of this is trying to probably take a little bit of pressure off his team. Some of this is just frustration that the Raptors continuously seem to be on this treadmill of, oh, okay, like, there's some positive momentum building. You beat a bunch of bad teams. Great. You beat the Pistons. Oh, we're going to really celebrate gutsy wins against the Wizards in overtime? Like, that's where this franchise is? Middling games against the Chicago Bulls, where it was kind of back and forth with a team that I keep looking at Chicago and saying, I don't know how you're winning any games. I don't understand how your team is any good. Although they did beat Denver last night, so maybe I should put a little bit more respect on them. But I don't know if this is a Raptors thing. I think all teams and all leagues feel a certain way about officiating. They can get upset. They can get angry. We've certainly seen this with the Toronto Blue Jays. I mentioned that there's a lot of 2015 Blue Jays vibes to this Raptors team, except for this Raptors team stinks, and that Blue Jays team was really good. And it's one thing when you're a winner and you're complaining about the officiating and you're looking for that every edge. I don't know. It just, there are times with this stuff where it really feels like sore loser things. And the Scott Foster call is obviously aggressively bad. Unless Scotty Barnes did say something about y'all are cheating or whatever. I still haven't seen anything conclusive that tells me one way or another. So I don't really feel too comfortable feeling like one way or another. But I still feel like there's this culture on this team where they pop off more about the officiating than a lot of other groups. Like, I watch a lot of basketball. Everybody bitches at the refs. Everybody's mad at the refs. There's not a lot of coaches that go the lengths Nick Nurse does to berate officials, who goes tomato red and is screaming at them essentially like down the stretch. Even the call the other night against Denver, the review that he had, that's just like a pure emotion call where your coach is losing his top and freaking out on the officials. And like, you really thought they were going to overturn an off-ball foul where there was clear contact between the two guys, like because of a phantom hook you thought you saw? Anyway, I really wish this team could check a little bit of this at times. I wish the fan base could check a little bit of this at times. I feel like it's just a complete runaway train. I've said it before. I think that we as sports fans in the current culture where it's harder to criticize athletes without being considered a hater, that it's just easier to funnel blame towards officials. It's a kind of the one thing we can all sort of agree on. But last night, like the fouls, I think there were 5 extra personal fouls for the Clippers. And I think that made sense given the way they played that game. I didn't think the officiating was bad last night. In fact, I never had one moment watching that basketball game where I went, man, officials rot tonight. This is a bad one. I had that thought in the Denver game. Like, I felt like actually they gave the Raptors a really great whistle, and then it was too good, so they went completely the other way. And then the end of the game, Scott Foster obviously lost his cool. And I think, again, unless Scottie Barnes really did say that, it is one of the worst calls of the NBA season. Either way, Raps got outplayed. The story of the game was that they came out in the third quarter, it was a tie ball game, and the Clippers kicked their ass. They outscored them by 9 in the quarter, and they were just the better team the rest of the way. And the Raptors had one of their little mini fake comebacks, but ultimately the Clippers were just a better basketball team. And I thought a lot about Kawhi last night and how this franchise had an identity the year after he left, because it was the identity of screw you, Kawhi, we're running this back and we're all champions. We're going to play like champions. Pandemic hits, derails things, weird bubble ending. Great OG shot, though. Still one of my favorite Raptors memories. And yet still, they've been searching for an identity ever since. And you always see little pieces of this, but it just never fully feels there. Anyway, Will Liu, the Raptors show, which is the best, joins me now. What's up, man? How are we doing?
That was a hell of an intro, man. I love listening to your thoughts on the Raps, man. This is pretty honest.
Yeah, thanks. I don't understand the ref thing. Like, again, you watch a lot of basketball. This is like your go-to thing. I know that officials suck. Like, a lot of them are bad at their jobs. A lot of them, I mean, wait till we watch March Madness and people are going to be going, oh, right. There's a huge
love the block charge in college. My goodness. Everything.
Yeah, you want to see some hero officiating? Like, get ready. As kids are crying, playing their last basketball game and seeing this. But where do you think this comes from? Because, like, I always think back, like, is this a Lowry? Is this a lasting imprint that he left on this group because he's so hard on the officials? Is this a Nick Nurse thing, like where it's top down, you see your coach comport himself a certain way and so you feel like you can kind of do this? Like, tell me if I'm wrong, that there is an added element of the Raptors where they really do seem to have added animosity against officials, like on a lot of given nights.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's a surprise. I think you can always add the caveat that lots of teams in the league complain about the officiating, but, you know, it was kind of explained to me that, like, the Raptors are near the top. I think it does start with the top. I think, Nick is one of those guys that thinks he's the smartest guy in the room with these officials. And it's not just that he'll throw them under the bus occasionally. It's not that he'll just complain. I mean, the amount of times the camera pans over and he's like beat red, screaming at whichever ref, you know, that you just lose count of those over the course of the season. But it's things like there's 1 minute left and the game is already decided, but he'll challenge just to prove a point. Smartest guy in the room kind of thing is very apparent. But no, I mean, I think on the player side, you're pretty astute. Like, you know, Kyle definitely complained a ton to the officials. Kyle's another one of those guys who was genuinely the smartest guy in the room. He would study the ref book, the rule book. He would, you know every detail. And it was good. I think that, you know, that actually helped the Raptors gain an edge. I also think that, like, just on a human level, you probably have more of a capacity to put up with complaining from a really good team, which the Raptors were really good, at least in the regular season, versus a team that's just like very, very average, like we're seeing right now with the Raptors. And you just like don't want to hear it on some certain levels from the Raptors. Like, a lot of the times they're just getting beat flat out. Like, you know, I didn't think Fred had that much deflecting going on yesterday when he talked about Ben Taylor. I think, you know, he mentioned how it feels personal. I think the people have looked into this, and like 4 of his 6 texts or 5 of his 8 texts on the season have been called by, you know, Ben Taylor's games, if not Ben Taylor himself. So that definitely feels very strange. One of those games he was ejected. But like, I do think that over the course of the game, I agree with you. Like, I think the Clippers are just better than the Raptors. The Raptors play defense poorly outside of forcing turnovers. The Clippers had a layup line going to the basket, and you're going to end up fouling a lot of these guys when they go to the hoop that often. So I didn't think it was an officiating issue yesterday outside of Ben Taylor giving Fred that tech. The other game against Denver, that's a little bit different. But, yeah, no, this team just – they complain, man. Top down, they complain.
Yeah, they really do. And you know what? And this is probably a version of confirmation bias because I'm looking for stuff and I see it. But I will say that one of the things that really does seem to annoy me about this Raptors team, and when we talk about like them losing in close games, like they've played – I looked it up today. They've played the six most clutch minutes of any team in the NBA. Like they've played – so for those of you that don't know, it's like a score within five with 5 minutes remaining. The Raptors play a ton of those. I actually thought it was going to be higher given, you know, the amount of games that they've played within 10, the amount of games that they've played within three where their record is just horrific. Games that are that tight, it's been awful. And there's this kind of thought that's been a little pervasive around the Raptors this season that, hey, well, when you lose a lot of close games, a lot of that is bad luck. And I go, okay, to a degree, do some bounces not go your way? Absolutely. But there are times, and I saw it last night in that Clippers game, and it really frustrated me, where things start to go against the Raptors, whether it's a run by the other team or whether it's like some bad officiating. And that's what I felt like in the Denver game too, where it just sort of derails them and you can see a funk kind of spread throughout the team where guys either stop playing the exact same way or guys seem to be a little bit more defeated. And I hate singling out one guy in regards with this, but it actually has been one of my biggest issues with Scottie Barnes this season. I'm like, yeah, man, you won Rookie of the Year. Like, you're a very good player, but do you really feel as though you should be one of the guys in the league that gets, like, what, Kevin Durant-level type of calls? Like, why are you having – there was a Grizzlies game I was at this season where, like, it was painful watching the way Scottie Barnes was interacting with officials knowing, like, he was a sophomore player. And I just think, like, this team has let moments like this – really hurt them more than people have kind of outspoken or actually gone out and said it. Like, they have a little bit of, hey, we can lose our composure more than I think that they are discussed.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think you're right to point out Scottie's involvement in that too. I mean, I think the officiating is probably going to continue to look at him like a rookie. The Rookie of the Year thing, like, honestly, like, you just can't let it get to your head to like to this degree, you know? Like, even when you look at the voting, like, if we did a redraft of that draft right now, I don't think Scottie's going number one. I don't think even at the end of last season, having won Rookie of the Year, if you did a big redraft, he wouldn't be the consensus number one. He might be in contention with Cade and Mobley at the very top, and probably there was a good case to put for Scottie number one at that time. But based on how this season has gone, you wouldn't put him at number one. And also, when you look at the voting, it was like, it was decided by four votes. It was like one of the closest Rookie of the Year races ever. But my point is, I was like, you just can't let that get to your head. You have to play through that. For a guy like Scottie too, like, he's going to play through a lot of physicality just because that's the nature of his game, right? He like forces his way in there. He's a bit awkward, but, you know, at the same time, he's also very, very strong. He's able to get to a lot of his spots, especially when he's really determined, like we saw at the end of the game. And it does seem to be a different level of determination at the end of the game versus over the balance of the game. But like, that's just, if that's the game he's going to play, which, you know, is a good one right now, then he needs to accept that he's at the mercy of the officiating. You know, it's similar to Pascal in that same way where, you know, Pascal sometimes at the start of the season, I thought he was doing a great job of beating the defense, taking it really strong. As the season's gone on, it feels like he's gotten more and more tired. And now you're seeing a lot more like spin, throw up a floater, yell A, and then hope that like the call comes, right? So it's the same kind of deal where you're at the mercy of the officiating. So you can't just like lose your head when you don't get the call each time. Right. And, you know, it's not really to single any of those guys out, but, you know, I think that it is very, very obvious when you watch it and you just can't disengage. Like, the Raptors aren't good enough of a team to not focus on the details of the game. And each time I watch the team, especially of late, I'm just like, you know, I know you guys aren't going to close out strong, right? We know the Raptors, for a fact, are not a strong fourth quarter team. We know that, you know, they've blown multiple double digit leads in the fourth, all that kind of stuff. And when it comes down to a stretch, you don't have that one consistent guy that gets you a great shot. If that's the case, then I'm going to need you to not be in so many close games and nail all the details, which is how you maintain big leads. And that's where, you know, the Raptors just don't have great discipline in terms of how they play. I mean, you even saw in the third quarter when it started to really unravel, the Raptors were just taking bad shots And then the Clippers will go the other way and break for a dunk. And all of a sudden, you're down like double digits to the Clippers. And you know you're not going to make a comeback against this team just based on the offensive potential that you have in your roster versus theirs. So, yeah, I mean, it's a frustrating game. But also at the same time, like, you know, the Raptors have to mature in that sense.
Dude, it's why I love, like, I love watching your Twitter account during the Denver game because you just knew. You were already on top. No, the Raptors are playing this really good game. There's a ton of positivity. And all of a sudden, like, you know, you're pointing out some of these plays where it's just like completely falling asleep at the wheel. And I'm going, this is going to accumulate. And Will's tweeting about it. He's going, this is going to accumulate. And then boom, all of a sudden the Raptors lose. People are going, it's all Scott Foster's fault. I was like, you should look back at Will's Twitter feed because I don't think it's just all Scott Foster's fault.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's easier to blame Scott, though. There's no doubt. And also, you can't eject him in that situation, man. That is pretty tough.
I like how, as a huge Chris Paul fan, I've made basically a life hating Scott Foster. Like, I already had this home, you know, on hating Scott Foster Island. And then everyone, like, started boating over. And I was like, no, this is not even the beginning. Like, you don't even have a clue how much hating of Scott Foster I've been doing for my entire life. Okay, so... I do want to pivot to just like a bit of the Kawhi conversation because it feels a little muted now. I guess we're just now entering the era of this is far back enough where we don't get overly sentimental with things when we see Kawhi. But yeah, how do you feel watching him right now, especially as he's starting to actually play basketball consistently in heavy minutes consistently again and like looking like him, his old self?
Yeah, I mean, my thing right now is I think there's still another level for him to go. I didn't think, like, Kawhi played all out yesterday. He played 40 minutes, which is pretty much Kawhi going all out. But I think in terms of the intensity and focus and execution, I think there's still another level for him to hit, which is truly scary. Like, I mean, look, there's stars in the league that just have that next gear, you know? Like, you could look at it across the board and the stats might look similar. I think I was actually pretty surprised when they put up a graphic in the broadcast yesterday when they were like, the head-to-head matchups the last five games, Pascal's averaging 30 and Kawhi's averaging 16 in this matchup between the Clippers and the Raptors. And I'm like, that's really impressive to me, especially because, you know, Pascal shouldn't really dominate this matchup against the Clippers based on how many great wing defenders they have. But I'm also thinking about, like, I know in my heart of hearts that, like, when it comes down to a close game or when it's needed, Kawhi will hit that next gear. And I just think that there's still something else for him to hit when it comes time for the playoffs. Meanwhile, I'm looking at since the calendar flipped, and in 2023, he's averaging 50-50-90 splits, playing like 37 minutes a game. And he's only missed four games in that stretch, and they're all back-to-backs where he sat out due to load management, which is what he did in the championship season as well, right? So he's gone back, at least for now, health-wise, to, you know, where he normally is. They're still just giving him the regular load management, but he's not missing any additional time because of that. And again, the man is shooting 50-50-90. And it's not like he's only taking like two threes a game. He's taking like six threes a game and he's hitting 50 of them. And he's just such a, I mean, he's like the best player ever to have put on a Raptors uniform. We know that. Not to say that he had the best Raptors career. Those are two different conversations, but we're talking about strictly who's the very best player to have ever put on a Raptors uniform. It was Kawhi. And when you see it time and time again, when the Raptors play them and they lose to the Clippers, I'm just like, that's what the Raptors are missing. I mean, it's pretty obvious, but it's like that level of player could change so much for this team. You know, like all these other small problems that you have, they get solved when you have a guy like that who could just come in and just dominate no matter what. Like OG was draped all over him. The Raptors sending extra defenders. And this guy just goes calmly for another 50% shooting game, 24 points, 12 rebounds, 4 assists. Like that was nothing for him, you know?
Yeah. So I missed Kawhi last night. Like,
I missed Kawhi every night, man. Come on, are you kidding me?
Yeah. No, but I watching him play and just – so one of my favorite things about Kawhi, and I guess this is not just a Raptors thing, this has always been a Kawhi thing, is he has his game and then you look at the box score and you're like, really? And, like, that's the stats? It's because, yeah, like you said, he's an efficient player. So he's not a huge volume guy where you go, oh, crap, like, this is the eye-popping number because he took a million shots. Like, I didn't want to, no disrespect to Kobe, but it was kind of like the opposite thing where I used to look at Kobe Bryant box scores. People would be like, he had 35 points, and I'd be like, holy crap, yeah, he took 35 shots. Like, that's the box score. That made sense. He was involved in every play. Kawhi just last night, I thought OG was actually playing pretty brilliant defense on him at times. He never looked bothered by it. He stayed pretty calm. The only times he looked like remotely frustrated was when his teammates were turning the ball over way too much. And again, not an efficient thing, and it's guy's an efficient player. But yeah, 24 and 12, he felt like he controlled the game a ton. He's getting to some of his spots, whether it was at the rim or some of the stuff in the mid-range, some of it just deferring to teammates and drawing a ton of attention. And I went, and this is kind of alluding to what I was talking to earlier about the identity of the team, is the Raptors since he left, it just, watching them, all I could think of last night is this is still a team that is basically built to be good around Kawhi. Like, that's what the team is still. It feels like they keep hoping that Barnes is going to be Kawhi, or that OG can be closer to Kawhi, or Pascal can be closer to Kawhi. And we just like have done this over and over and over with the team. And then you watch him play, and you're just watching him, and you go, oh, right, that was the identity. And I don't know if Masai has moved off of it based on his affection for 6'9" guys. But that just still feels like what the Raptors are, is like a team that has a huge hole in their heart, and that hole is Kawhi.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that pattern before, right? You know, sometimes you miss your ex.
Yeah.
You have a rebound situation. No, I mean, like, look, listen, yeah. You put Kawhi on the Raptors, the Raptors are a championship contender right now, right here, right now. Like, no other pieces added, the Raptors are a championship contender right now with Kawhi. But obviously it doesn't work like that, right? Yeah. I mean, look, this is it's not that dissimilar to most teams in the league. Like, you know, most teams don't have that level of separating talent. And they're just kind of waiting for that moment to come along. I think from the Raptors' perspective, they've clearly chosen to sort of keep their asset base as it is, probably will try to resign their guys, try to maintain their value. And again, of course, when the next Kawhi trade comes along, you have the opportunity with some of the pieces on your team to try to make one of those trades, right? They probably could have tried to tank the season. They chose not to. They surprised everybody by adding Jakob Poeltl instead. And look, listen, Jakob's looked good. Like, I've been pretty pleased with Jakob every game he plays.
He and Fred have been the best Raptors. Like, that's like those two guys basically every single night in the notes are like, they were the best two every night.
Yeah. You know, they play pick and roll nicely. I thought the Clippers actually did a really good job scouting the Raptors yesterday and just really shut that down. You know, and they put extra attention towards that. But I mean, like, ultimately, the Raptors could have chosen to go in the draft route and try to got one of those guys, but I don't think they want to do that. I think they want to continue to do what they're doing right now, struggle a little bit, try to improve in the margins, hope maturity catches up with them. I mean, look, there is definitely potential with Scotty to, you know, make that kind of star jump. And if we could just see that fourth quarter urgency for the entire game, you know, that I think that probably changes sort of the overall perception of how we see him, and also just like his success as a player so far overall in the season. But yeah, I mean, you do just eventually wait for one of these Kawhi types to float around. Like, that's unfortunately the NBA. Like, you know, most teams are mid until they get like a top five player, and then you're really serious for a while, and hopefully you can do something with it while they're happy with you.
So I do want to talk about some of those things, because yeah, last time we talked it was before the deadline, and yeah, it was pretty set in terms of what was going to happen. And even, like, I was listening to your show post-deadline. You were talking about, yeah, the contracts are going to have to resign, the fact they've only gotten the luxury tax once. And you go, okay, like, how are we going to decide these things? So I do wonder how certain things are going to get shaped with this stretch run, or what is actually on the table, considering, like, what we've been seeing so far. But, yeah, just before we get into that, what do you think the Kawhi Raptors legacy gets touched in any way if the Clippers do win? Because I couldn't help but think about that last night, especially as Kevin Durant goes down. He looks brilliant. That Clippers team looks good. Although, yeah, the Westbrook thing is still ready to just derail all of it. Watching him miss all those wide open corner threes in the beginning of the game, and Raptors just not defend him, I was like, oh, he actually was okay. Like, he did some nice Russ things later. But yeah, I can't help but feel like there's going to be a huge game where Russ derails them, and people are going to go, wait, you wouldn't give up Terrence Mann and a first for Van Vliet? Like, that probably would have helped you a lot more. But yeah, how do you feel about the Kawhi legacy if the Clippers and, yeah, Lawrence Frank and co end up with a ring with him?
Yeah, look, I would hate it just because of the stalking that the Clippers did all season. I still remember Steve Ballmer, who is like, I don't know, man. How many how many billions does he have? Like probably 50, something like that. Am I overestimating it? But he's like genuinely one of the wealthiest men in the world, and decided to go to Detroit to sit courtside in January. Yeah. To watch Pistons Raptors as the owner of the Clippers.
He has 82 billion US, by the way.
Oh, 82? Sorry. My bad. Yeah, I'm sorry, man. Yeah. I'm sorry, Steve. I didn't mean to miscalculate.
You shorted him a slight $30 billion.
No big deal, man.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, like the personal thing is what I wouldn't like about the Clippers. But I don't think it actually affects his Raptors legacy. I mean, like, I think what Kawhi did with the Raptors is like untouchable, really. Like, it's not just like what he did, it's also in the fashion that he did it, right? Like, no matter what he does with the Clippers, even if they win a championship, which I still doubt, because they don't have great chemistry around him, but like the shot is the shot. Like, you can't recreate that. Kawhi probably couldn't recreate that if he wanted to. You look at the opposition that the Raptors played against, the circumstances that he played against, like, you know, 7-game series against that Sixers team, or beating the Bucks and or beating the Warriors. And listen, like, I know KD got hurt and eventually Klay got hurt too, but like, you're still beating the Warriors, man. How many teams in this league can say they've beaten the Warriors in the playoffs? Like, it's like two teams who have ever really done that since the Warriors have became the Warriors. So yeah, I mean, you know, I think that that's, I'm secure with that, but obviously I'm rooting against the Clippers because of the fact that they, you know, stocked the whole team, then they like restocked themselves right now with so many former Raptors. It's just like, all right, man, enough is enough.
I'm rooting so hard against it, and that's actually the worst part, is that I just want to root for Norm Powell. Like, I love Norm Powell. Want to root for his teams badly. Like, he could be in any other situation and I would go, if the Raptors are out, like, I'll just bandwagon in on the Norm Powell team or Chris Paul, one of the two. Like, that's basically the move. And I can't do that because he's on the Clippers. I would hate it so much. And you're right. Here, that's always going to be special. I do think maybe it makes things a little bit sour from a fan base standpoint towards Kawhi a little bit more. Like, this fan base has always been very much, hey, we respect that you left and you went to Los Angeles, and thanks for the memories. Thanks for coming out. I've never really been as much that. I think I've probably been on the more bitter end, where I go, yeah, it's just basketball to run it back. Like, you win, you stay on the floor. Yep. That's the principle of the game. You had this championship-winning team, and yeah, you had the opportunity to be one of the greatest winners of all time, and if you're with that Raptors group and you go back-to-back, like, that does put you into a completely different echelon. Fine, you went home, but I also think that you should be criticized for it, and I really didn't love it how everyone was just like, or not everyone, but a lot of people were like, zero criticism, zero anything, who cares, he just left. If he does win one, I wonder how the fan base will react, just in terms of seeing him celebrate that and knowing, like, maybe it makes it a little bit more real that he would have won a championship here had he stayed, right? Like, it's one thing when he's hurt every single year and all the press clippings are, hey, Kawhi's teammates hate his guts, he never shows up for anything, and then he's hurt, and then he tries to come back, and the chemistry of the team is really bad. If he ends up winning one, I think it'll change it a little bit. And then the secondary part of it that scares me a bit is the Clippers are getting that new stadium, the Lakers are kind of in a down cycle where we don't know what's going to happen with them next. We would just have a lot of narratives of, like, Kawhi being the Vince Carter of the Clippers, essentially, where it's like he created a whole fan base there. It would mean a lot to him because he is an LA guy. I don't know. There's just some stuff that scares me a little bit with it. I just want Kawhi's last championship to be a Raptors championship, all right? Like, never let there be another one. May there never, ever, ever be another one. And I saw your Clippers contenders or pretenders.
Yeah.
I want to believe they're pretenders, but then the KD injury happened yesterday, and I went, if this Kawhi shows up in the postseason, like, chemistry stuff.
Oh, there's no if, man. You know this is happening in the postseason. Come on, man.
Yeah.
You know that he's going to be this level of excellent, if not better, in the postseason. No, I mean, look, listen, I think that makes sense, man. This is really just like the two approaches towards, like, you know, okay, the relationship ended sooner than you wanted it to. You have two ways to sort of look at it, right? One, you were like, man, I'm really happy that it happened. And, you know, if it happened again, I'd be open to it. But, you know, and then the other end is just like, screw it, man. You left something good and I don't want good things for you. Like, these are the normal two responses. So, like, yeah. I understand.
I have both at times. Like, again, I am very grateful for the way Kawhi played, the way he gutted out through injuries.
Of course.
But, like, I also remember he was forced to come here, and the Spurs basically thought they were sending him to Siberia, and, like, that was his punishment, like, for turning on them, and that they would not let him go to the Lakers. It wasn't like he thought, you know, the Raptors, that's a team on the rise. I want to go there. I want to rip it up in Toronto for a season and leave. But, yeah, anyway. All right, this offseason, some of the stuff that we're watching right now, how it's changed our perception of certain things. Yeah, like I know you were talking about Fred and Yak again the other day on your show, but yeah, how much money do you think Van Vliet has earned himself with this play as of late? Because all of a sudden, like, I know this is only his last five games, but he's averaging 9 or 10 dimes a game. He and Jakob Poeltl look really great together. Van Vliet just seems to be playing with just more confidence in general, even though the shooting numbers still continue to be a bit of an issue. But yeah, like, has this run with that player been the biggest foundational change for you in terms of like something you feel a little bit more guaranteed moving forward, or is it something else?
No, I mean, I've always just thought that like you can't just let Fred walk in free agency and not get anything back. That would be the worst outcome in this situation because you don't have much guard depth at all. It's not one of those situations where you let a guy walk and you have opportunities behind them. Like the Raptors don't have that. Like it's like you let him walk and Malachi gets promoted or Jeff Downey gets promoted. Like it's just hard knowing all of that. Obviously, there's going to be concerns about Fred because of how inconsistent, you know, his play has been this season. I think the worrisome thing is that when he really doesn't have it, it's like 1 of 11 for 3 points, like that kind of stuff, right? So I think that the bottom falls out. But then again, when he's good, you're like, okay, clearly this is what the Raptors need is more quality guard play, and Fred has more of that potential than anybody else on the roster. Even Gary, who I think at certain times probably had a public rating that was stronger than Fred's. I mean, we know that there are more things that Fred can do than what Gary can do, right? Gary's probably 100%. A better finisher on the season right now. But ultimately, in terms of the creation, in terms of the defense, is not the same. I mean, I don't know if he's like making himself more money from this, basically. I mean, I think he has the Raptors in a very leveraged spot. Like, the Raptors don't have alternatives. They don't have the open cap space to sign anyone else. There's nobody else on the market who is like Fred level or better that the Raptors can sign based on their money. And also, like, you know, the Raptors don't have any internal other options. So I think the Raptors are pretty leveraged in this sense with Fred. They just have to hope that they have a good relationship and that they're able to negotiate the price. But I think the price is kind of what the price is going to be. And he is a very quality player. And I think that, I think too, like in games like the game against Denver yesterday, like sometimes when the Raptors get into a tough game, I'm just like, who really cares? Like, who's going to try to at least lift this team? You know, and whatever, like most times it doesn't end up happening or working well, but I do at least feel the sense of respect when it's like, okay, this guy cares the most and is trying to lift them back into the team. It's not just like an even opportunity thing, right? And I do think that those are character showing moments where you're on the road, it's tough, who's going to try to spark them? And I do respect that Scotty tries to take over sometimes in the fourth. And I do respect that, you know, Fred over the balance of the game usually tries to take on that responsibility. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think Bjork has definitely helped them. I think running more plays through Fred has helped them too. I think the start of the season when they were like, you're playing off ball, you're just going to walk around and catch and shoot for three, and we're going to let Scotty take over as like the number two option on this team. I don't think that really materialized in terms of the skill set or even the desire right now. From Scotty's perspective, I think he's still just like not good enough at touching the paint consistently, not good enough at generating his own shot. And it felt like too much too soon. And I think the front office put that on Scotty that early. I think they had to reshift expectations, especially when Pascal went out. All of a sudden, Fred became number one option while Pascal was out. And then when everyone was healthy again, it became sort of like, okay, what's going on? Eventually, they did start getting Fred going by putting the ball in his hands and running way more plays through him. I think that does have downhill effects in terms of like Pascal's not having like the same stellar year anymore because of the fact that they're putting the ball more in Fred's hands. And I do think that, okay, that does leave Scotty to mostly run point with the backup units. But ultimately, I don't even care about that kind of stuff. I just want to see the Raptors like put together a winning product. Whatever the coach decides is the best way for the Raptors to try to compete, that's what I'm going to try to roll with and assess from there. But I think Yak definitely helps them on that front to have a pick and roll partner that has good hands and good feet. Is a big difference. I think Fred running pick and rolls with Ken Burch and Precious Achiuwa has just never gone anywhere. Maybe it worked when it was him and Scotty. But I don't think defensively it was that viable to consistently run with Scotty at center. And so that has helped Fred's case. But I think Fred's case was always solid. I think it was more of like, we just want Fred to play good consistently rather than like, we need to get rid of him no matter what. So
yeah, I never looked at it as like, you need to get rid of Fred. To me, I thought that he would have more value on the market. And it was pretty surprising reading those Clippers reports of, like I mentioned, they didn't want to do man in a first. And I went, huh? Okay. Like, I get that he's got the contract looming and whatever, but you've got a franchise player that obviously still wanted a point guard and has widely wanted a point guard for years. You just tried the John Wall thing and that didn't work. So why not go out and get somebody that does have pedigree, who has played with your guy and is part of a formula that works. That was a little surprising, but I think from the money standpoint for him this season, maybe he's even just, I guess, leveraged himself into a bit better of a spot, because you know Jakob Poeltl's coming back. He's been the best fit with him stylistically. You mentioned that they don't have a lot of guard play. Gary Trent Jr.'s stock has gone down. Maybe they can get him on a friendlier contract. I don't know. It's still always, I guess the big thing for me is nothing has changed in regards to my feeling of you're not going to go into luxury tax with this team. There's just no justification for it. And so somebody's got to go. And now you're either losing Gary Trent Jr. for nothing. You're terrified that Fred VanVleet knows that the Raptors tried to trade him to the Clippers and he takes that personally. But again, he is a classic money will fix anything guy. That is his whole thing. Raptors pay him the biggest bag and he will not care about whatever rumors happen, whatever went down. And then there's the OG thing where I'm watching him these last couple games and it's hard not to just go, you can't lose that guy. It's easier to understand why Masai Ujiri would double clutch on trading him for three first round picks when you watch the way that he defended Nikola Jokic, and then you watch the way he defends Kawhi. And yesterday, he's just knocking down threes and shooting it confidently. And you go, you're the perfect role player, man. You're the perfect guy for this role. It just seems like maybe you want more than this and you want to explore more than this and you don't want to be here. And I think that the big feeling for me has just been, I wonder how much of the stretch is going to potentially change their opinion on trying to gear things towards him a little bit more, but how that even works in terms of trying to make him happy with a contract and with the right role and with, just kind of repairing that relationship.
I think at the end of the day, everybody is one of those guys. Very few people in the world are not you pay me the biggest bag and I'm happy kind of guys. With respect to what they do for their profession. And if they do, they're probably obscenely rich. And so their incentives change. I think there's probably a very difficult path, but I think the front office probably sees a scenario where, depending on how you structure the contracts, you can avoid the luxury tax next year. That might involve having to trade OG for more future pieces. If you want to still compete and you trade OG for future pieces, first off, I would really like to know what those pieces are. But second of all, if you do that, then you're going to have a huge gap in your defense, right? That means Scottie's going to have to take on even more defensive responsibility. And then past that, it's probably going to be Fred and Pascal who have to take on more defensive responsibility. Are you okay with that? Are you going to win with that? I think it probably depends on the return you get. But the whole conversation about keeping the guys happy and stuff like that, yeah, I understand that for sure. That is definitely a natural thing. I think especially in the NBA, that's such a big point of conversation. But also to me, I'm just ultimately you got to take care of the work at hand first, right? The person who needs to be happy more than anything else in professional sports is the fan base, because they need to see the winning product. Because that's the whole point of everyone coming out there and spending the money and doing, having a good time, is to see that. So we got to take care of the bottom line first and foremost. And you know what? I don't really want to hear as much from players in a losing situation of I'm not happy. I could have done this. I could have done that. How about you do that already? And then we just, stop losing, and I'm not trying to be obtuse in that sense, but I'm just it feels like we're putting the cart before the horse in that situation. Let's win the games and then let's worry about you being happy.
No, you're bang on. It's not lost on me that ticket prices are going up 20%.
It's hilarious that they're going up 20%, man.
What a jump. What a massive jump in terms of price increase. And I know this is, it's not on the players, whatever. But I'm sure you've gotten these too, privately, from friends and observers of this team. Is one of the most common texts I get about the Raptors right now is people that are afraid that they are just going to run back this exact group. Where they go, what's going to change? I don't want to, I'm going to pay 20% increase in tickets. And I'm talking about people who are ticket holders who go, they want me to now pay 20%. And the whole conversation is that they're going to give Gary Trent Jr. more money, Fred VanVleet more money, and then potentially re-sign Jakob Poeltl everyone's going to come back and they're going to try to improve around the fringes. And like, this is what I'm going to be paying my hard earned dollars for. Like, no, you're bang on. I think the only thing with the OG conversation is just simply like, he seems to be this one guy that they're kind of open to trading, but then they turn out 3 first round picks for OG, and people are kind of trying to make this leap of, well, they must've all been bad picks. I haven't seen that report anywhere. And it's like, not like, those teams, like especially New Orleans right now, like they're chock full of just horrific picks. So if you're going to turn that price point down, like you're right, there's got to be something pretty massive coming in. And I think his stock has only gone up, and like his importance to this team is just becoming more and more clear. So they're just in a really tough position right now, and that's why I'm watching all these games through the lens of what the hell is going to happen this offseason, what are they going to do, because there are so many things to take care of. But you're right, satisfying the fan base and getting people back on board and having them feel like there's actually a direction to this organization, and yeah, that there's buy-in and that they're getting back into the entertainment dollar rather than, yeah, a lot of ref bitching and close game losing and yeah, pouting. I think, and that's number one. You're right. That is 100% number one.
Yeah. No, let's be honest, like that most likely they're going to run this back. Like they made the decision at the trade deadline. Like they might maybe move one or two players in terms of in the offseason or probably at the time of the draft. You know, it was pretty telling when Masai had his press conference, which, by the way, was definitely the most swaggerless Masai press conference I've heard. Normally, a Masai press conference is like a sermon, and everyone's really into it and all that other stuff, and you feel really inspired afterwards. This one was like, oh man, he had to walk back the play-in for what? Right now, it's playing for everything.
Please don't remind me. I'm not like no more GIF. Like just like as I'm remembering this press conference, and it was just a nightmare. Like what a nightmare it was. Yep. Yeah, the walking back the play-in game thing was. Oh my god. Yeah. No. I can't. I just can't live that again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like one of the things that Masai said that time was just like, look, all the deals that we got today, I feel like they'd be here down the line, right? So I think that he was like, okay. If that's the case, let's at least try to diagnose a problem. We're bringing in a center. That's clearly the one piece that we're missing in terms of just the unbalance of the lineup. Let's bring him in. Let's see how that impacts things, how that steadies things, and then we can reevaluate from there. I mean, obviously, that's Masai's favorite word is reevaluate. But, yeah, I mean, like, you know, they can make the decision still, I think, at the time of the draft. But, you know, and the free agency portion is difficult, though. Like, if you let any of these guys go, it better be at least signing trades, because again, the Raptors have put themselves in this situation where these guys together haven't really produced, especially this season. But at the same time, you also can't afford to lose any of these guys. So, and yeah, so it's a tough spot, man. And it's not like there's like tons of talent coming up the pipeline too. I think like if you had that scenario where you're like, okay, this team's not gonna do it, but they're going to turn this thing over and they're going to get all these other guys in and you're going to see more of those guys. Like, you're not going to sell tickets based on the exciting potential of some of the young guys that they have, right? Maybe some people are still like, yo, I'm going to pay extra 20% to come see Scotty. I think he's definitely the guy with the most potential. But, like, again, like, I don't know. If they did this last year, I would understand. Coming off of this year, it is just kind of hilarious. And again, it's just, you got to respect the consumer, man, please. Like, that's 100%, ultimately the customer 100%. In the doors is the person you're worried about.
Yes, especially this consumer base that has been so good, so loyal, so just, and they rewarded with a championship recently. But yeah, God,
yeah, of course,
like there is, you know, Raptors fans, it is just a different breed of fan in this city that just goes, yeah, to the absolute hilt for this team, has defended this team in so many ways. And now it's like, yeah, guess what, Masai? Like, you have figured out that adding a center has made you better. It still hasn't made you good enough to beat the good teams. And all you're doing is being, like, you look better, I guess, against the bad teams. Like, great. Like, you've separated yourself from the bottom further. You found yourself basically no closer to the top. You continue just to be the team that is the quote-unquote tough out, but you're still an out. Like, you're still out. Like, you're going to be out. You're not beating these good teams. And yeah, ticket prices going up, players that you kind of need to bring back who have a lot of leverage against you. It is, yeah, very, very, very strange days for the Toronto Raptors. And yeah, when you said things coming up the pipeline, a few, it's like, no, there's Scotty Barnes and this, it's completely barren. Like, yeah, I'm pretty sure anybody that was holding Precious at Chewish stock is like,
oh, I was just going to ask you, man, what your thoughts on Precious last night? 3 fouls in 3 minutes in this first shift with 2 airballed layups.
He was +3. He was like the only guy.
Plus minus, man.
I know. Yeah. He was the only guy with a plus, and I was like, this is actually what I would send to anybody in the stats community who ever uses plus minus to determine like how someone played. This is proof. This is the exception that proves the rule. Oh, I don't know, man. Like, the precious stuff at this point is like, he's got the thing that I've just never – I always wonder about like certain things. Like in baseball, can you improve your feel for the strike zone? Can you have like a better eye? And in basketball, it's like, can you improve your hands? Like when you've got salmon hands like Precious Achiuwa has, is that something like you can make appreciably better? And I just haven't seen it, and I feel like all the rest of his game kind of around it, especially offensively, crumbles. And like he doesn't look confident. I don't know. Yeah. I'm really not trying to be too bad or down on a guy while he's down or kick him while he's down. Mm-hmm. But I think in this game, if you're going to be a big, you have to be able to play in the pick and roll. And he just does not seem to be able to do that. And I haven't seen any, like, have you even seen a blip of improvement in that regard? Like, I haven't.
I thought he looked good when he was with the starters.
Yeah.
He was shooting much better. And look, that's normal. Like, you're going to get guys setting you up. Like, Pascal setting him up, Fred was setting him up, all that kind of stuff. Scotty was setting him up. But, yeah, coming off the bench when he's asked to sort of just, like, play in a slightly different role where less guys are sort of, like, comfortable with you, like, he just doesn't really show to me the awareness. And maybe that's not too unusual considering he came to basketball late and also he's still very young in his career. But it's just, like, some of the stuff with the hands, I do feel like he catches the ball fine when he's with the starters. It's not great. I wouldn't say he's got Jacoperto hands, but, like, he's more okay in terms of knowing where his spots are. When he comes off the bench, I just don't feel like he has a good game plan in terms of how he wants to attack it. Hurts his confidence, I think, for sure. And I think he is a confidence player like most young guys are. But yeah. I think, yeah, I mean, there's plays yesterday where, I mean, Fred got an assist to OG for this for a three, but Fred ran a pick and roll with Precious. And then Fred drove into the lane and Precious, like, cut him off with his role. Like, he literally bumped Fred with his role. And it's just like, that's like evidence of like lack of awareness in terms of knowing how to play the game right now. And, you know, it's that I guess that only can come with time and experience. I mean, Precious is undoniably our second best prospect, though. So I'm still not getting rid of
that's
the stock.
That's not what I want to hear.
But he is. He absolutely is our second best prospect.
I know, but
if you were sitting down
and I was like buying a team or I was like being shopped, if you were like, hey, you can be the next general manager of this team, and I'd be like, all right. And they'd be like, let me see the prospects. And they went like, we have Scotty Barnes. I'd be like, wow, that's nice. That's a really good start. And then they'd be like, who's next? And they'd be like, Precious Achiuwa. I'd be like, oh. Who's the next call? Like, who's the next meeting? Like, let's see who we've got up next. Either way.
We got him for free for the call, everything.
Yeah. All right. That's the only. That's the ultimate defeatism right there. It's like, we got it for free. You're like, all right. Well, yeah, you can't really complain about free stuff. That's usually the way that it goes. Will Liu, the Raptor Show later today. Can't wait to listen. It's excellent as always. See you, pal. Thanks for coming on.
Appreciate you, man.
Cheers, buddy. Will Liu, the Raptor Show. Quick break. Let's come back. So I once had a girlfriend who worked in IT. And one day my computer was on the fritz. I had a crappy old thing. And I asked her to take a look at it. And she did. But what I didn't realize is like she would see my entire internet browsing history like in full. It wasn't great. The one thing was, though, that she did say is, you do really like this site, Pro Football Talk. I did go there all the time, and I still do. The creator of that site, the author of Playmakers, and NBC Sports is Mike Florio, the man. What's up, buddy? How we doing?
What's going on, man? How are you?
I'm good. I really loved your Dan Snyder take from the other day. I got to tell you, the idea of him just like trying to stick it with contracts, guaranteed money to the next owner, I'm like... That I think that's a window into – is that a window into what you believe could happen or a window into your soul of what you would do?
Here's how it came to me. No, it's not what I would do. I say no. Do not compare me ever to Daniel Snyder in any way, shape, or form.
I wasn't doing that.
We had Ron Rivera, the coach of the Commanders, on PFT Live 4 weeks ago at the Super Bowl. And we asked him about his quarterback situation. Now, last year, the Commanders called every team, literally every team, to see if they had a quarterback that was available in trade because they had felt that they had been burned the prior year by the Matthew Stafford trade. And it was kind of an inside job between the Lions and the Rams. Brad Holmes, the GM of the Lions, had just come from the Rams. And it was a perfect swap because the Rams were looking to unload a god-awful Jared Goff contract. But the Commanders' attitude was, hey, we didn't.
Oh, we lost Mike. We'll call him back there. The dreaded bounce thing. It is good that we do have that trigger, that failsafe, the little bounce thing, the little boom, when it's gone. I got to tell you, I know that they're trying to get new ownership. My Lamar nightmare situation is him going to Washington. Like, there's just something about the RG3 vibes and the way that franchise has been run the last bunch of years. I just, out of all the possible destinations, that's one of the lower ones for me. Anyway, sorry, Mike Florio joins us again. Mike, you were just saying about, them feeling like they got burned on the Matt Stafford sweepstakes and how that's impacting the now.
Right. So last year they tried every team to look for a quarterback. They ended up with Carson Wentz. Now they're going in the other direction, supposedly. Rivera told us that Sam Howell is QB1. Now he's since amended that to say that doesn't necessarily mean he's going to be the starter. But he did tell us they're not going after a veteran starter this year. And I'm not saying he wasn't telling me the truth, because the easy thing for them to say now is, at the time he made that statement, they never would have dreamed that Lamar Jackson would be available via the non-exclusive franchise.
Lost him again. Mike, what's up with your phone? Mike, get it together. At least finish the answer. Let's get that out of this one answer before we start. We get cooked, as Joe likes to say. This phone, wherever he is, like, I thought this was America. They got no cell phones. They got no Rogers. That's the problem. Gotta have Rogers, the best one, as I always say to every person I meet. As soon as I meet them, I say to people when they don't have Rogers, I'm like, you don't have Rogers? What's wrong with you? Get it together. Get a grip, brothers and sisters. Only that is what I say every single time. It's basically, you know, I'm like a dummy where you pull one of those strings. Anyways, we're waiting to get Mike back on. Hopefully we figure out how to get whatever his service provider is. Like, they figure out this dead spot, figure out whatever's going on. I wonder this. Like, this is basically where I'm going with this with Mike. I do wonder, so free agency, the signing period opens up March 15th. Lamar Jackson has this non-exclusive franchise tag thing hanging over him. And there seems to be all these teams lining up to say that they're not in on Lamar Jackson, which, surface value, I don't understand for the reasons I went over yesterday. Like, you compare him to the three guys that got paid last offseason, and it doesn't make any sense. Oh, apparently Mike Florio's on a landline now, which, whew, huge, huge news. Mike, we got you again?
Yeah, I decided to go with the landline just because it may be on my end, although I've done two or three of these already today and it hasn't been an issue on my cell. But just in case, if we get dropped Mike. This time, it means the Commanders are trying to keep me from spreading this word north of the border.
Yeah. So I like, listen, our technical director, he gets into it with a lot of people. Like, he has a lot of rivalries, and I guess you guys are now the new rivalry. Like, Mike Florio versus Austin Mackey, like, who will come out on top? If it drops on the landline, I'll tell you this, Austin is fired, okay? So
right.
There you go. Big stakes for
right,
Austin.
Well, I'm tempted to just hang up and say it dropped now, but I don't want to get anybody fired. So the combination of my just kind of spider sense that maybe they're in the weeds for Lamar Jackson, when you consider it will make the team better, Lamar Jackson versus Sam Howell, I mean, are you kidding me? And then you throw in the fact that you do a 5-year fully guaranteed contract, which no one wants to do. The league doesn't want teams to do it. The power structure doesn't want teams to do it. Well, number one, you give the league and the power structure a middle finger while they're pushing you out the door, which I think is intriguing, and you stick the next owner with the bill for the Lamar Jackson contract. And I know the reaction to that is, well, you know, it's going to drive down the purchase price. Well, is it really going to affect the purchase price? I mean, you've got a salary cap. You've got a salary floor. Money has to be spent. The next owner may not care at all about a 5-year fully guaranteed contract. That person just wants to buy the team. So I just think there is a fascinating number of wrinkles that point to the Commanders, and that's the team I'm watching. Because, again, all it takes is one team to do something like this, and that one team very well could be the team in Washington.
So what do you make of the list of teams that came out and basically right away was like, we're not in on him? Are you buying any of that? Is that smokescreen stuff? Like, I know you pointed to that potentially being collusion stuff. Like, what are we supposed to make of the amount of teams that apparently are not in on Lamar?
Well, and, you know, collusion happens in the NFL. It is not uncommon. Somebody asked me how it happens or why it happens or whatever the case may be. Here's the comparison. Because the NFL 32 teams are supposedly independent companies that compete in all respects, on the field, off the field, financially, et cetera. Now, they have the cover of what they call a multi-employer bargaining unit that allows them to have rules that apply across all teams for salary cap, player salaries, franchise tag, et cetera, because all of the players are in the same bargaining unit for all 32 teams. But anything beyond that, this is no different. And they get together four times a year to talk shop. This is like the CEO of McDonald's, Burger King, Taco Bell, Long John Silver's, Tim Hortons, I guess, would be relevant up in your neck of the woods. And they all get together four times a year, and they talk about how they're going to do business and how they're going to do this and how they're going to set prices and how they're going to pay employees. It's an antitrust violation under federal law. It's collusion. It's not allowed. And the aftermath of the Deshaun Watson contract last year that the Browns gave after they had been removed from the four-team competition to get Deshaun Watson, they had alienated Baker Mayfield, they swooped back in with a five-year fully guaranteed contract, it was clear that that is frowned upon within the NFL establishment. So I think what's going on this year, I think teams are pulling the plug prematurely on any conversation with Lamar Jackson so they don't have to say no when he says, I want a five-year fully guaranteed contract. They never get to that point in the dance. So think about how much worse it would be if seven teams talked to him and the reporting became that seven different teams were told five-year fully guaranteed contract and seven teams said, we're not doing that. We don't do business like that around here. That makes it easier to prove collusion. Now what we have, we're multiple steps removed from even getting to that point. You just have teams saying, we're not interested. How can you not be interested in a guy who was a league MVP, one of the most dynamic players in the league, and he's available? Guys like this don't typically become available. When they do, there's a caveat. Peyton Manning, after four neck surgeries, he was available, and it worked out. Tom Brady, available after 19 years with the Patriots. But just to have a guy like that out there, I mean, look, Aaron Rodgers is available, and look what's happening. The Jets have zeroed in on him, and they're trying to trade for him, and it's crickets so far for Lamar Jackson. So I just thought it was odd that immediately after the Ravens apply the non-exclusive tag, it's Falcons are out, Panthers are out, Dolphins are out. It's something about it seemed weird to me, and I think many other people agreed with that assessment.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And here it's not our big fast food joints. It's our grocery stores that keep getting run into the collusion problem and bread fixing scandals, and like, yeah, Canada's got a big issue there. That's our one. That's how we relate to what's going on with Lamar Jackson. So yeah, you've got these teams that are saying that they're not in on him. Now there's like this public shifting of a narrative too, that the Ravens are playing this incredibly smart. Do you think that this is like increasing the odds that he actually just returns to Baltimore, or do you think that this is still going to eventually end up with him somewhere else?
Well, if no one is going to pursue him, then the Ravens continue to hold his rights. Now, I think we are farther down the road than anyone realizes as to the possibility he doesn't play at all in 2023. And that seems incomprehensible to most people. But consider how this plays out. And the first big domino to fall is using the non-exclusive franchise tag, because that puts him in line for a salary of $32.4 million for 2023. So if no one signs him to an offer sheet, and the Ravens would then either have the chance to match it or say, no thank you, you can take him, we'll take two first-round picks. And then if the Ravens don't sign him to a long-term contract by July 15, that's the deadline. For any franchise tag player, you have to sign him to a long-term contract before July 15. After that, it can only be a one-year deal. So we get to July 16, because why would we think the Ravens and Lamar Jackson are going to work out a long-term deal now? They haven't been able to, in large part because he doesn't have an agent. We get to July 16. He's not under contract yet. He hasn't accepted it yet by July 16. $32.4 million. What's he going to do? Is he going to play for $32.4 million? I could see him saying to the Ravens, hey, you could have used the higher level of the tag on me for $45 million. I'm not playing unless you give me $45 million. I'm not setting foot on that field for $32.4 million. And next thing you know, Lamar Jackson's not playing at all in 2023. It's not as ridiculous as it sounds in isolation when you consider the circumstances and you consider how things could play out from here.
Considering the injuries and, yeah, my affinity to watch Lamar Jackson play football, I really hope that that's not this scenario that happens. Do you think that this quarterback class is changing the way certain teams are thinking? Because even some of those groups that we thought should be in on Lamar, they could find ways to move up the draft, or they could end up in spots where somebody does slip. It seems like Anthony Richardson's stock has gone through the roof and is actually sort of changing the complexion of this thing, where now maybe there's four quarterbacks that could be selected pretty high. Like, how much is just the timing of this hurting Lamar?
Well, you know, the question always is, when you have free agency, when you have veterans available, what is the team's objective? Is it to take their chances on a guy in the draft? Do they feel comfortable about where they are as it relates to getting a guy who may be available in the draft? That's not a problem for the Commanders, but it's a problem for some of these other teams in the top 10. When you consider who's there, there's several teams that need quarterbacks. The Falcons, the Panthers, the Raiders are in that mix. The Texans, the Colts. So that's half the top 10 right there. Seahawks act like they're interested, not that they would make a play for Lamar Jackson. But you could have a dynamic where a team waits to see what happens in round one of the draft, and if they don't get Lamar Jackson, if they don't get the quarterback they want, then they could pursue Lamar Jackson. And here's the beauty of it if you're the team. If you sign him to an offer sheet now and the Ravens don't match it, the Ravens get your 2023 and 2024 first-round pick. If you wait until after the draft and you sign him to an offer sheet and the Ravens don't match it, the Ravens get your 2024 and 2025. So if you're going to do it at all, it's better to do it after the draft anyway. And if all these teams are backing off and there's no real smoke out there that anyone's thinking about doing it, why not wait? And especially a team like the Dolphins, who have to wait because they don't have a first-round pick this year. They can't even talk to him until after the draft. So it's entirely possible that this is something that goes into mothballs until after the draft, and we see which players are taken by which teams and which teams are left saying, I don't know who my quarterback's going to be. That could develop an urgency to go after Lamar Jackson at that point when we get into May.
See, Mike, this is why it's so good you came on. This is such a confusing situation, and now you're starting to lay all the reasons for why it is actually happening. And I feel bad for my brother, who is a huge Ravens fan, because this is not going the way that I think he's – like, he's listening to this podcast right now, and he's now at this juncture, and he's going, this is not the thing I wanted today. This is not what I was expecting to hear. Okay, so you mentioned the Rodgers with the Jets thing. Feels like this is it for both of these sides, right? Like – if the Jets miss out on Rodgers, they're screwed. And if Rodgers doesn't want to go to the Jets, who the hell else wants him? Like, what's your level of confidence this just happens between these two parties? Like, he's a Jet next year.
Well, I mean, the first thing I'm confident about is he's not going to be a Packer. There's a lot of toothpaste that needs to be put back in the tube for him to go back to Green Bay. It was a year to the day after he renewed his vows with the Packers in 2022 that this all came out about the Jets. And we don't go down this path. I mean, it was just 2 years ago that the 49ers called the Packers the day before the draft and said, could we trade for Aaron Rodgers? And they basically laughed and hung up the phone. Look how far we've come in less than 2 years. The Packers now seem like they are holding their breath and crossing their fingers and toes, waiting for a deal that gets Aaron Rodgers off their books. So it feels like it's moving in that direction. Now, I think the Jets would have other options if they don't get Aaron Rodgers, but good luck selling those other options to your fan base if you don't get Aaron Rodgers, because you could have had Aaron Rodgers. And it's clear that they want him. When all of the power players in the organization get on a plane and fly to California, that means they want him and they're trying to convince him to come to them. If he wants them, and he's trying to convince them to sign him, he gets on the plane and flies from California back to New York. So they want him. They're pulling out all the stops. They're giving him all the power as a practical matter. I mean, you're basically writing a blank check to Aaron Rodgers as it relates to authority and how they're going to do things. And my guess is all of those Packers players that he wants on the team are going to be signed by the Jets, Randall Cobb and Mercedes Lewis and this guy and that guy. So I feel like the Jets have decided to basically sell their soul, and the question is, does Aaron Rodgers want to buy it?
Boy, I don't know how the Jets fans go from Aaron Rodgers to, what, like Jimmy Garoppolo? Ryan Tannehill. It's not.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And there aren't many other options out there. You know, Garoppolo has kind of bubbled to the top of the list right now with all these other moves that have happened between Lamar Jackson, no one interested, Aaron Rodgers goes to the Jets, Derek Carr goes to the Saints, Tom Brady goes to retirement, supposedly. Jimmy Garoppolo is going to be one of the more attractive names when everything fires up next week.
All right, so you've always been the guy that's the most plugged into the Tom Brady situation. Like, you were way, way, way ahead of the Dolphins stuff. Like, they basically could have just come to you right away and been like, hey, sort this out, figure out exactly what's going on between these two sides. You had it a million years before it went down. What's your read on the Tom Brady thing? Because he sat at that beach and said, like, this one is for real this time, guys. And I bought it. And now maybe not. Maybe the Dolphins relationship isn't over. Like, where do you think this goes now?
Here's the most important thing Tom Brady has said this year, and it happened on his podcast, Let's Go. Jim Gray, the co-host, said to him after he retired, Jim Gray said, Tom, you said once upon a time that you will retire when you suck. You don't suck. Why are you retiring? And Brady said, very simply and very nonchalantly, I believed it when I said it. And it occurred to me yesterday, that is a powerful statement. That is even stronger than George Costanza, it's not true if you believe it. I believed it when I said it. So when he said he was done on that beach, where somebody put a jar of that sand on eBay and there was some ridiculously high price attached to it, he can say later, I believed it when I said it. But we don't know what he's going to think, and he doesn't know what he's going to think when June or July roll around. He rolls out of bed one day, I miss football. I can still play football. You know, the worst thing he could have is regret when he's 60 or 70 and too old to play that he didn't play as long as he could. And I feel like there's no way of knowing with certainty that he's not going to wake up one morning between now and the start of training camp, or maybe during the season. Maybe it'll take an injury. Maybe he'll do half a season. Who knows? But I'm not going to believe he's done. I was saying until he doesn't play at all for 1 year. I've now amended that. I need to see two full seasons go by with him not playing before I fully believe he's done.
Man. Well, that would just be something now if he just. And you're right. Like, what does he care if he goes back on his Instagram video? Like,
right?
Ooh,
there's no. Yeah. I mean, he's gone back on many things that he said. It doesn't matter. He retired last year and he came back. Now, when he retired last year, he wasn't really retiring from the NFL. He was retiring from the Buccaneers, or at least trying to. This year, and one of the other selling points. Had to cough. No cough button on my landline. But the idea that by retiring when he did, and when he submitted that retirement letter, he completely avoided any pressure that the Buccaneers may have applied to him to do a one-year dummy contract that would have knocked down a $35 million dead money charge they're going to take this year, and technically would have had him under contract with the Buccaneers. He's going to be a free agent next week. That retirement letter means nothing. It's not binding. It doesn't even count. He still can sign with another team. He doesn't even have to do anything to take it back. He can sign with another team, and he's under contract with that team. So I'm not saying it's going to happen next week, but he will become a free agent next week, and he will stay a free agent as long as he wants to until he would sign a contract with another team.
Author of Playmakers, which you can go buy right now wherever books are sold, creator of Pro Football Talk, host of PFT Live, Mike Florio. I hope you patch things up with Austin because, yeah, I love having you on. So
just make the note in the file. Next time we do it, just go straight to the landline.
Yeah, we will. That's going to be done. Hey, Mike, thanks for joining me today.
All right,
appreciate
you.
Your time. Take care. Mike Florio, author of Playmakers. Yeah. Okay, so much there. So much good there. The Tom thing, Tommy. Are we I feel like the biggest sucker who ever lived buying that. I'm the biggest sucker behind the guy who actually bought that retirement sand. Oh my God. Could you imagine? You bought $100,000 worth of sand and it's just like there's no way. It says bidding for the beach sand went over 100K according to Jobo. I cannot believe a person bought the beach sand for that much. Like, there's just, why wouldn't you just go there and collect more sand? It's not like the person gutted the entire beach. But even if you paid, $100 for that, like $100 for that sand on the exact retirement spot, you got to be the stupidest person who ever lived, first of all, because that is just outrageously dumb way to spend your money. Like, you, please donate to charity. If you're going to be out here buying thousands of dollars worth of sand Tom Brady sat in and did a fake retirement video, you got to be committed, or you have to donate money to a charity right now, like more than what you bought for the sand. Anyway, that guy is sucker number one. I feel like sucker number two, because when he said the whole, hey, this is the real deal, this is the real retirement thing, I went, he means it. Tom means it. Wrong. Okay, so this is just going to be me now putting some of the breadcrumbs together. Here's what I think is going to happen. This is me guessing. The AFC East is going to have Josh Allen for sure. And then the other three quarterbacks right now completely up in the air. I don't know if the Patriots want to bring back Mac Jones. Maybe they end up trading him. Kind of ran out of time because the bonks to the landlines over and over and over again. But it feels like the Patriots don't really love Mac Jones and they might want to move off of him. So maybe they reunite with Jimmy G. Either way, it feels like the Patriots situation is kind of irrelevant and that they look like the team that's going to be going into the dumpster. The Jets end up with Aaron Rodgers because, like Mike said, he's not going to be a Packer next year. And what are the other franchises that appear to be lining up for him? Sure, maybe there's some teams that can wait, but it seems like the Jets are the most desperate. They've got their owner whining and dining him at this point. Rodgers, classic, playing hard to get. You knew he was that kind of guy. That's what he's going to do, blah, blah, blah. He's going to be a New York Jet. He has to be a New York Jet. If he's not a New York Jet, the Jets are cursed. It's just official. My friend Sean, you got to leave the team. Matthew Barnaby, you got to leave the team. You got to go to greener pastures because it's just not fair. It's just not right. So Aaron Rodgers ends up there. Here's my bold prediction. The Dolphins at some point next year, maybe because they don't get Brady right away, but that they end up with Tom Brady or Lamar Jackson. What Mike said there is so smart. You're telling me that Lamar can return home into the only colors that he would look probably better in than the purple, the Ravens purple, which is synonymous. The purple and black with Lamar Jackson, God, he looks so good in it. But if you put him in the Miami Dolphins gear, that looks gorgeous. That guy loves Miami. He is Miami. You tell me he doesn't want to go down there and play with the freak? Like, after all this time where I want to say Lamar has had, he's had horrific receivers. Everybody knows that. But in terms of the actual asset allocation into wide receivers that Lamar Jackson's, like the Baltimore Ravens have decided to do, where they've said, yeah, we're essentially going to spend zero money at the position. The last four seasons, this is according to Warren Sharp, the Ravens were the second cheapest in the NFL on wide receivers. 4 years with Lamar. That's criminal. You're telling me that he's not looking at Tyreek? He's not looking at Jalen Waddle and he's going, that'd be fun. I'm down to do that. I'm down to chuck the rock to those fellas. Let's see if I really can't play quarterback. Let's see if all the criticisms that I've been taking, all the bullets I've been taking since the start of my career, haven't been maybe Greg Roman issues, maybe offensive design issues, maybe the fact that, again, you guys refuse to go out and get me a wide receiver. So not only do you try to pinch me on the wide receiver money, you're going to try to pinch me on my own money? Nah. Peace. Miami. Miami Dolphins, new quarterback, Lamar Jackson, but has to be after the draft. So this thing could linger, this thing could stay, but at this point, reading everything Mike Florio is saying, sorry, D, my brother, I love you to death. I enjoyed all those times we went and saw Lamar, except for the time in Seattle where he whooped up on my Hawks and I had to suffer the indignity of that walk with you. Lamar is gone. It's just a matter of when. He's not taking $32 million. Like, Mike is right. You think he's taking less to go back to the Ravens? You think the Ravens got him? That in this era of player empowerment, in this era where this player doesn't have an agent and he's like fully believing in himself, that he's just going to bend the knee to Baltimore, that he's going to come back and say, yeah, sure, 32 mil, whatever, even if they go up to 40 mil. They don't want to give him that money. They're not going to give him that money. Jason Lacanfora told us this months ago. This has been a thing that has been brewing for a very long-ass time with Lamar and the Ravens. So we can say the Ravens are playing the smart, whatever the hell. Maybe they're going to optimize the assets they get back. They ain't not keeping Lamar. Florio basically just said he'd rather not play. He'd rather not play football than come back to the Ravens at a discounted rate or one that is not on a fully guaranteed contract, which, again, why would the Ravens start to do that now? So, yeah, I'm going to predict that Lamar Jackson is either going to be a Dolphin or Tom Brady will be, and that's what they're going to suss out. Which of these two options should we take? I actually think that Tom Brady, at this point of his career, the Dolphins are kind of perfect for him, where he can just, you know, have these two elite receivers get the ball out quickly. But make no mistake, you would infinity rather have Lamar Jackson over Tom Brady. The problem is, would you rather have Tom Brady and that Dolphins team and keep your first round picks, or Lamar Jackson and lose him? So there you go, Dolphins fans. That's going to be one hell of a division. What a fun. Although maybe this just ends up the new AFC West, where we just overhype the crap out of it and we go like, holy crap, look at these teams. And then the Bills just roll it again. Bills fans would love that. Anyways, let's take a quick break. I mentioned before, Jason Bukala, former professional scout, years and years and years in the league, excellent part of our television broadcast. He's doing a series of deadline evaluations of Canadian teams' prospects. He started with the Leafs. And I read the piece. It was very good. I don't know how Leaf fans are going to feel about the way that he was talking about the prospects. A little good, a decent amount of bad. Not sure there's really any depth. Either way, let's break down some of the Leafs' top prospects next with Jason Bukala.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, so I mentioned Jason Bukala crushed it on... You know, Jason, actually, I'll bring you in on this. You know what was one of the top texts I got about Sportsnet's coverage on deadline day? It was that you guys crushed it, like your panel murdered. So congratulations to that.
Wow, that's nice to hear. We appreciate any type of feedback. We're like the C team, so any type of feedback we can get like that, that's awesome. We appreciate it.
Yeah, it was good, man. You guys did a great job. And again, you're writing for Sportsnet.ca. You're a former professional scout, and you're doing a series looking at the prospects of the Canadiens teams and how they did after the deadline. So you started with the Toronto Maple Leafs. I read it last night. It started great. It started great for the Leafs. Your stuff with Nyes was awesome. And then, yeah, it trickles down and gets a little bit like... Actually, it happened very, very quickly. It was a very precipitous fall off. But let's start with Nyes. I really like this quote. Was, quote, taking his game to another level in all three zones, end quote. What's the area you've seen him most improve?
Well, you know, in years gone by, even when he was a pre-draft prospect, he was always a big body, and he could do some positive things from the hash marks down in the offensive zone. What he's done now is he's taken his pace in terms of going up and down the ice consistently to another level. He's killing penalties consistently. He's being deployed in overtime when required. So defensive zone faceoffs, like his defensive zone starts, are way up. It tells you a story that the coach trusts him a lot more, that he's put in the work, he's put in the detail, he's not just a one-trick pony. And that's really important, because when he does arrive to the pro game, if he's not scoring goals or producing offense, what this kid's going to do is he's going to lean on opponents to open up space for more darting players on his line. And if he can get, if he can be heavy on the defensive side as well and win little battles, chip pucks, transport it between the blue lines, all those other little skill attributes become a huge bonus. And then, you know, when he does pull on a Leaf jersey, Sheldon Keith can look down and he knows that he can trust him in a variety of roles.
Yeah. You think he's NHL ready right now? Like, if they decide to throw him in the lineup in the coming weeks, is he going to be able to already contribute to this team? Is he a above replacement player for what they already have?
I think he is. I'm on record, so it's not like I'm beating the player up, but, you know, a guy like Kerfoot, who doesn't really go to the hard areas at all. He's a darting player, as we know, and he can kill penalties and he can play fast. And I saw recently he got elevated, I mean, temporarily at least in the lineup. But this is a guy that you could, like I just said, if he's not scoring, he can play it fast enough and he can do those other little things that will give him a chance to get in the lineup sooner than later. So, he could just definitely step right in. Minnesota is the number one ranked team in NCAA hockey. The Frozen Four is like the first weekend in April if they get that far. So it'll be interesting to see. I don't have a crystal ball, you know, suggesting he's definitely coming out and he's definitely signing. But if I were asked the question, would I give him a game and see if he can play for us and be a part of our playoff roster, I would absolutely say yes. He's a candidate for that.
Yeah. I do wonder how difficult it's going to be for him to just step in when the intensity is this high. But this is part of your evaluation that I hope, if there's, like, this is probably one of the harder things to evaluate, but I hope it would have some meaning, which is, you know, you outlined that he's got a knack for big goals. And I spoke with him about a month ago now, and even when I was looking at his stats then, I went, holy crap, you got a lot of game-winning goals. And granted, he plays on a good team, right? And he's a top-line guy, so some of that is, all right, yeah, that's going to happen naturally. But how do you take that as a prospect evaluator? Like, we always debate in the sports world about, like, what clutch is and what a big-game player is. But, yeah, how much do you take into evaluations when there is somebody like that, enough for you to at least, you know, put it in a mention in a scouting report?
Well, some players, you know, they want to have the puck in big-time scenarios, you know, overtimes or, you know, game on the line, power play late in the third period, whatever the case may be. He plays on a high-end line there, like with Cooley and Snuggerud. And, you know, they're absolutely great players. Cooley's a distributor more than he's a shooter, so he obviously makes those guys or gets some pucks in quiet areas. But the thing with Knies is, and I'm not making this up, over 95% of his shots on goal, his quality shots on goal, come from between the hash marks in the middle of the ice. So there's some players that like to get pucks and, you know, they'll release it from the perimeter, hope for a rebound. We've all seen that. You know, when guys come off the rush and they go far post for a rebound. This is a guy that gets to the middle of the ice and creates grade A scoring chances when he does get pucks on goal. So of his, I don't know, I think he's averaging almost four shots per game on goal. His shooting percentage is, you know, what it should be. This guy finds the hard areas to get pucks to the net and scores goals in big times or key times of the game. He's just a winner. Like, he makes everybody around you better. And he's not, I don't want anybody to misunderstand, this guy's not going to be an 80-point guy when he plays in the league. He's going to be like a 30-30 guy, you know, like, or maybe at best a 35-25. He's not a huge distributor. But of those 35 goals, you're going to walk away at the end of the year and you're going to say, oh, my God, you know, there's 10 huge goals that he scored this year that stand out.
Yeah, Jason, though, this is exactly what this team needs. Like, that's why they went out and tried to acquire some bodies in their bottom six at the deadline that, yeah, could create a little bit more traffic in front of the net that could go to those dirty areas. Because you're right. I think that part of the reason they decided to move out a guy like Pierre Engvall was he was allergic to that space. And yeah, you're right. Alex Kerfoot has not exactly been that either for them. And so, yeah, for them to have a guy, a kid, who has that size and who is that confident going into those areas, like, there are some players, when you have a skill set that is not replicable throughout the rest of the lineup, that makes you even more valuable. So you can totally understand why Kyle Dubas coveted this kid, not only because of, yeah, just like all of the things that you've outlined, but that, yeah, God, they're just sorely, sorely, sorely needing that, especially going into, yeah, the postseason, where that's where you get a lot of the goals. That's part of the correlation between you saying he has a knack for big goals is that he goes to the areas where it's difficult to play in, but you end up being rewarded with those big moments. Okay, so moving down the Leafs lineup here, the second prospect that you have in the list is pretty solid evaluation, I guess. Yeah, what kind of a leap have we seen this year from Fraser Minton?
So a year ago, actually, yeah, around this time last year, because COVID delayed everything, you know, the prospects game, for example, let's use that as a leaping off point for him last year. I thought the Leafs stepped on him in terms of where they drafted him. I had him just a little bit later, but it's, you know, you're splitting hairs when you're within 10 guys in the second round. So, you know, it's like give and take. Last year at this time, you know, I didn't see a player that had enough of the three zone detail and bump for his size and effort that translated to me to be a potential 2F, if you will, like even if he's a low end two. I had him more like a low end three, a two-way forward. What I'm seeing this year, though, is that every category, similar to Nyes, has come forward. He's leaped forward in every category. So now he's being used in all situations. You know, obviously Kamloops is hosting the Memorial Cup. He's going to have a long run here, which is good for his development. What I really liked is that his release from distance and the way he's getting pucks to the net, everything's quicker, everything's more accurate. So like when he... You know when sometimes you watch the Leafs and they're going and Matthews runs that high cycle, he comes off kind of the half wall, the boards, he comes up top and he gets the puck on the power play and he releases the puck to the net. Mitten has that in him too. Like he'll come off this little cycle and he gets pucks to the net quickly and accurately. So that's a bonus. I like that he's tracking back. He's assisting defensively. So again, he's not a guy that you have to worry about in defensive zone starts. And he fronts pucks. He blocks shots. He's got good size. He gets out. He's not afraid to block a shot. He's not afraid to do some of the little things that are required. Because, again, we're not talking about a guy who's going to be an 80-point NHL player. And that's why I think he's a low-end two. He's going to complement higher-end skill guys. Like, imagine him playing with, like, a Nylander and whoever. Like, he complements those types of guys. Similar to what O'Reilly does right now when he's healthy, if you know, I'm trying to paint a picture. But he'd be a high-end three, a lower-end two, trustworthy, making progress in all categories, so that's a positive.
So he's only 18 years old. What do you think the timeline is for a guy like that?
Oh, he's at least 3 years away.
Boy.
Yeah, he's at least 3 years away. Yeah,
still with the team then.
Well, and that's part of it, right? Like, if you look at their roster and you look at the depth of the roster, there's going to be a lot of moving parts, you know, expiring contracts, salary cap, you know, who you're extending, et cetera. So some of these guys might get rushed, unfortunately. Like, a Minton might arrive sooner than he should, only because they need for that to happen. But hopefully they've still got a little bit of protection in their lineup, like, you know, like the Steves and the McMahon, those kinds of guys in the organization that can kind of fill some roles temporarily, and then Minton might be able to be in and out when he's 21 years old.
So I'm going to jump down your prospect ranking for someone who's a little bit more, I think the fan base is a little bit more familiar with. A season ago, fans were losing their minds over Topi Niemelä. You now have him fifth in the Leafs organizational chart here on your latest piece. And yeah, this was one of the most common things that ended up happening to me was at the deadline, people would text me or write me or tweet me, whatever. And they would go, yeah, what about the Leafs offering Topi Niemelä in a trade? Or, hey, the Leafs did a really good job of keeping Topi Niemelä. And then I would look at his numbers and I would go, what the hell is happening here? And yeah, it seems like from your vantage point, this season has been exactly what the numbers are suggesting, and that, like, yeah, his stock has fallen quite significantly.
So my biggest concern is obvious, and that is exactly what you just mentioned, JD. Like, his offense has fallen off dramatically. I mean, 50%, you know, and actually it's more than 50% because his games played is up compared to last year. So, you know, for Topi Niemelä to have the impact that I believe he needs to have at the NHL level, he's going to have to produce at worst secondary offense. He's going to have to be a part of, at worst, your secondary power play unit. Because although he's a crafty defender, he's a light kid, right? So he's similar to like Sandin that way. You know, he's a light defender. Sandin gave all he could here. I don't want to underestimate that, because he really did. Sandin gave all he could in Toronto, even physically. Like, he bumped up against people. But Niemelä is smart. He's an area defender for the most part. He'll do all the little things that you want him to do. He's quick to space. He's got a really high-end hockey IQ. My problem or my concern is that he's not transporting the puck quick enough to make plays offensively. That's one thing that stood out a lot this year. And so what I do, just so that listeners understand, like, I'll break down prospects like this in 10-game segments at the beginning of the year, middle of the year, end of the year. And then I'll try and, you know, if nothing changes, you don't want to give them something for free and you don't want to take something away after just like two or three mediocre games. For Niemela, his most recent 10-game segment just it trumped it for me. Like, it is what it is for this year now. And the fact that his offense has dropped off as much as it has is a huge concern. But between the blue lines, I just want to get back to when he's rushing pucks, he's not attacking with enough speed. So when he's got it on his stick, between the blue lines, even on the bigger ice over there, it's like for some reason he's got a hiccup in his game. He's not attacking with enough pace to back off the defender. And then, of course, you know, when the rest of the crew are joining the rush with you and you're slowing down and you're not dumping it and they're looking for you to make a play, things are breaking down. So he's off right now is the best way I can say it. He might get a chance to play for Finland at the Worlds. We'll see if he gets that opportunity and how he does. He's just okay for me right now, JD. So I'm monitoring that situation.
So the league is getting smaller. It's getting more skilled, which is why I think a lot of fans are higher on Ty Voigt because they see the numbers. It's pretty eye-popping. He's only 5'10". He's listed at 150 pounds. You have him as a player that's trending up, but also is the ceiling simply because of the size? Like, what is the limiting factor for him moving forward?
So he's trending up from the junior level in terms of being able to play the pro game. So I would just want to qualify that. For him, he's you know, like right now, if Nemo was playing in the American Hockey League, he'd have a tough time today just the way his game is, just because the American League is a heavy, hard game. Like, it's hard to play in the American League. Voigt could go in the American League and play in the second unit power play right now. Like, he makes plays in small areas. Like, he's got a ridiculous stick. He's really crafty. The rest of his game, and I tracked him, I saw him three times in the last few weeks, and the rest of his game is way off. So I have him as an organizational depth piece right now. Minor league depth, recall, skill guy is possible, but let me tell you, he's got a long, long, long way to go. He's got to play way faster. He's got to be more engaged in all three zones, and his body language has to improve. I don't want to beat the kid up too much, but all three times I saw him, and there's a little bit of sulk to his game. I didn't like it. It bothered me. And if I was in development in the Leaf organization, it would be one of those, listen, kid, you might be able to score at the OHL level with ease, but that type of body language reveals something to your opponent at the pro level. It doesn't work. So get it together.
Jason, again, great work on the panel. Great work for Sportsnet. People can go read your pieces up on sportsnet.ca right now. Again, his latest on the Leafs is Toronto Maple Leafs prospect report. What does Matthew Nyes project to be? There will be more with the other Canadiens teams coming. Thanks for making time today, Jay.
Absolutely, pal. Have a great day.
You too. Jason Bukala. I think it's important to do those kind of segments every once in a while, not to try to kick guys in the teeth. And I understand what Jason's saying. And to borrow the joke from Big Cat, they're just kids. So it always feels difficult. I get it, doing some of these evaluations. But yeah, if you look at his piece, it's like the Leafs have a guy and Nyes who's ready to impact this team and looks really good. Frazier Minton is 3 years away, as he put it, but is looks like a decent depth piece. And then after that, it's like, boy, oh boy, oh boy. Anyway, I don't want to write off Topi Niemela, but I think we need to stop discussing him and certainly Ty Voigt as though, you know, these are some kind of top prospects moving forward for an organization. We got to run. Subscribe to the podcast. Leave 5 stars. Retweet it. Share it. Do all those things. I'm off tomorrow, so I'll see you Monday.